New York, New York, it's a hell of a auto show town.
Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Henkel. Excellence is our passion.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy, episode 281 for April 2nd of 2015. Maximum luxury at the Big Apple Auto Show. Watch Autoline After Hours live at Autoline.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific or 19 hours GMT. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for Autoline in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Well, we've taken Autoline on the road. We're at the New York Auto Show. My co-host, Gary Vasilash, should be here, but dang it, he came down with some sort of bug. But no worries, because we got Michelle Krebs here from Auto Trader filling in as my co-host today. And Michelle, great having you here.
Happy to be here.
Should also mention that later in the show, we're going to have Joe Filippi, the consultant and forecaster and analyst with Auto Trends Consulting. And we're going to have Jamie Kittman from Automobile Magazine. But right now I have to introduce our special guest, Pierre Luan, the head of product planning for Nissan in the Americas. And Pierre, great having you on the show.
Thank you very much. Very honored to be with you today.
So, of course, there's one car we absolutely have to talk about because you're debuting the new Maxima at the New York Auto Show. And what a styling statement this car makes. Tell us a little bit about what you guys hope to achieve with this.
Maxima is a very important vehicle for us. It's probably our best nameplate. We've sold it continuously. It's the longest continuously sold nameplate for Nissan in the U.S. since 1981. It's now the eighth generation, so very, very strong for us, very, very important. With the new generation Maxima, we wanted to do three things. Exterior design, we previewed it with the sports sedan concept. The final vehicle is very close to that concept car. It was about performance, but fuel economy, 300 horsepower, 15% fuel economy improvement, and interior craftsmanship, attention to detail, because Maxima is one of those cars which cross shops somehow with luxury, despite Nissan being a non-luxury brand.
Is there a technology story? We haven't seen all the details of it, so maybe you could share some of the technology that's in it.
There's technology. The powertrain is, I would say, is a 2.0 version. It's V6 3.5, like previous generation. 61% of the parts are different. The transmission is the Gen 3 X-tronic. So all of this contributes.
CVT, continuously variable
absolutely,
transmission.
With D-step, which replicates somehow the way of working of a conventional AT. So this contributes to, on the one hand, 300 horsepower. On the other hand, 15% better fuel economy. Weight's reduced by 80 pounds. In terms of safety, the car adopts the full suite of what we call the safety shield, with, of course, blind spot warning, forward collision warning, but also something, a feature we've introduced on Murano, which we call predictive forward collision warning, sorry for the acronyms, but which through radar monitors not only the car that's immediately in front of you, but the car ahead of that one.
It bounces the signal under the car in
exactly,
front of you, right?
Exactly, sonar radar going under the car that's immediately in front of you to predict what's happening ahead, one car ahead, so that you have more time to react.
Talk a little bit more about the styling, because there's a tremendous resemblance between the Maxima and the new Murano as well. A really good family resemblance there.
Yeah, absolutely. Designers wanted to give a family resemblance at least to those two cars, which are close, again, to those two cars cross-shop with, to some extent, 10-15% with luxury brands. And family resemblance is the V-shaped grille, but it's also the floating roof, the character line on the side.
That little kick-up in the rear three-quarter panel, too.
Absolutely. Maxima is a very interesting example. The first review, the first design review we had at the very beginning of the process, early 2012, when typically we look at quarter-scale models, we had six or seven, I don't remember exactly, one immediately captured everybody's attention and was like, yeah, we want this one, which is rare. Because usually in that type of situation, you have, we'd like the front of this one, the rear of this one, the side of this one. On that day, we had a quarter scale model. We selected three, because that's the process. You go with three, go with two, go with one. The one that was selected is, in fact, very close to the car that you see today in production.
I have to ask you, this is a full-size car. That market has not been very strong. In fact, it's been shrinking. So why are you so optimistic about the Maxima in this segment?
I'm very optimistic because I don't believe in the segment classification for this type of vehicle.
Okay.
I mean, you look at that segment, the way manufacturers define it or analysts define it, it's relatively stable, 600,000, 650,000 a year. But it's extremely volatile inside. What you see is somebody brings a new car which somehow resonates with consumers, it's a hit. With Maxima, if you look at the past, we've sold, depending upon the years, between 50 and 80,000 a year. So it's not marginal. It's quite a big score. Again, reputation of the brand's very strong. I mean, I'll have to give you an anecdote. Being a foreigner, every time I get back into the country, I go through kind of a rigorous process. Who are you? What do you do? When I tell the CBP officer I work for Nissan and I'm in product planning, I'd say, and I'm not joking you, every second or third time, they spontaneously mention Maxima. My sister has one. When do you bring the next one? So it's that big of a nameplate for us.
Right.
So we believe the combination of this design, the performance, the way the car drives, because it drives really well, and the attention to detail inside will make it a success. You can never say it's guaranteed. You need to be humble in this business, but it's close to being guaranteed, I believe.
And I have to ask you, we got a little sneak peek of this in the Super Bowl, the ad, the famous dad ad that really captured the hearts of a lot of people. How did that come about that you decided to put that in the ad? And you didn't say it was the Maxima.
We didn't say it. It was written. So if you were able to stop, it was written. The car was badged. The story of the Super Bowl is it started a year before under Fred Diaz's leadership. Fred thought, and everybody agreed that we should come back and say something, say that, yeah, we're a big player in the U.S., so it's credible for us to be at the Super Bowl. And then the Super Bowl is, when you do those commercials, it's about telling a story. And that's I was told you either make people laugh or cry, which was our camp. But we wanted to make it special by unveiling a couple of things. And in fact, we unveiled two vehicles. One was the Maxima at the very end. The other one was the Le Mans car, which had not been seen before. And that, the story was about all of this, which, created a lot of buzz. You know the result. The
right.
Super Bowl ad won the Google contest. It was a top 10 ads with USA Today immediately after the Super Bowl. So I think we have at this stage 22.5 million views. It was a really, really big success for us.
What does the Maxima say about where you're going with the rest of the Nissan line?
The Maxima tells, in my view, the Maxima tells a story about where we're going in North America. Because it's at first a car for North America, and in fact, at first a car for the U.S. The overall volume, we sell 90% in North America, and out of those 90%, another probably 90% in the U.S., and the 10% remaining is Gulf countries, Emirates. So it's a car for the U.S. What it says is it resonates, in my view, with our brand caption, innovation that excites. There's a lot of innovation in this vehicle for safety, for performance, weight reduction, and it's certainly exciting to drive, really exciting to drive.
You know what I'm so impressed about, and I've said this before, is that Nissan has really stuck to using CVTs. You've really made them work. I'm blown away that it's in the Murano, a big vehicle, a heavy vehicle, all-wheel drive vehicle, and now the same thing in a full-size sedan. My question is, what's the public's reaction? Are they even aware of it, especially as you mentioned that you've got this sort of simulated step shifting to it, or not at all?
I believe that now that CVT has improved over generations, and you see other competitors coming to CVT, Asians in particular, and that we've been able to tune those CVT to retain the biggest advantage of a CVT, which is the opening, which gives you the fuel economy somehow and the lack of friction. But mimic somehow, and in some circumstances, when you are 50% on the accelerator pedal and beyond, mimic a step automatic transmission with some G-feel. I think the consumer does not care if it's a CVT. It's a two-pedal vehicle. I think they don't care. And on Maxima, at least on the SR version, so the sportier with the 19-inch wheels, we also have paddle shift, so you can use the transmission as a almost as a manual transmission or a dual clutch.
Mm-hmm. It's I think you're leading the way. I think we're going to see a whole lot more CVTs coming up in the near future, too.
We're clearly, I mean, we are a strong, I mean, we use CVT in quite a lot of our vehicles, from the very small ones up to, as you said, the Murano, the Pathfinder. We have a very strong partnership with JATCO. And the CVTs give us the scores and the results that we have in fuel economy. I mean, remember, Nissan was ranked the brand with the best fuel efficiency for those brands with a full lineup of cars. So, yeah, I mean, we have CVTs. We have a long experience with CVTs, and we're going to keep using those CVTs for the years to come.
Speaking of fuel economy, you haven't said any numbers. Are you sharing those yet?
I mean, yeah, I can. I mean, again, performance 300 horsepower, fuel economy improved by 15%, which gives you, forgive me, I forgot the different numbers, but the highway is 30 miles per gallon.
That's
pretty good. Pierre, you've got the Nissan Leaf, so you're able to get ZEV credits that way, but are you looking to add hybrids or plug-ins to the rest of the lineup, such as the new Maxima?
Maxima, maybe not, certainly not in the near future. Yeah, we have been working on hybrids. We're working on plug-in hybrids. We're working on other technologies. We have a Pathfinder hybrid. We have in the Infiniti lineup, we have a QX60 hybrid, and we will introduce more hybrids as time goes by, either in crossovers or potentially in sedans in the future.
Mm-hmm. So what's next up after Maxima?
After Maxima, I mean, this year for us, two very big events, Maxima, but also Titan behind us. Mm-hmm. Titan was unveiled in Detroit. In fact, we're going to launch Maxima commercially early summer. Titan will come later this year. Very big event for us. I mean, we have a Titan today. We do low volumes because the vehicle is quite old. It's quite old because for a long time, and there were several projects to replace it. One of them was Chrysler that didn't materialize. We believe we also have a very strong product with the two different chassis, with a full lineup, contrary to the current Titan, where we have only one engine, it's only two bodies. That's a very difficult segment because domestics do a great job. But somehow we have proven to ourselves in the very first years of Titan, of current generation, the first 2 years, we almost reached 100,000, so 4% market share. And our major Japanese competitor shows us that it's possible to sell a truck when you're Japanese, say between 100,000 and 200,000 trucks a year.
Where do you think the potential is for that? Where are you going to squeeze in amongst the domestics or certain markets?
Yeah, I mean, we haven't. If we were to get to probably around 5% segment share, I think that's what we could do. We've done it before. That's what we could do.
Pierre, Carlos Ghosn has set the goal of Nissan in the U.S. achieving 10% market share. I haven't seen the March numbers yet, but I know the month before you were about 9.1%, I think. But as a product planner, my question is, do you have the vehicles in the lineup you need to hit that 10% goal?
I better have them, because that's the...
I guess what I'm fishing for is, do you see others...
Any holes in the lineup?
Clearly, I mean, we talked about Titan. That's one of them. I mean, today we do less than 15,000 Titans a year. The segment's 2 million vehicles. We need to do much better. That's one. Second one, which was identified, was Sentra. Sentra, when you look at our major competitors, they used to outsell us 3-1, roughly. It's now 3-2. There's nothing to be really proud of, but it's already much better.
Yeah.
So once you close these two and you get to where the Nissan brand should be compared to those two major Japanese competitors, you're getting close. After that, yeah, we still have a few things, but stay tuned.
You seem to be bucking the trend of a lot of companies have struggled on the small car side, but it seems like Nissan is posting increase after increase of Sentra, Versa. What are you doing there?
Yeah, I mean, Sentra, we've worked consistently to improve the product. Every model year, we've improved the product since we've launched the new generation. The capacity as well. As you know, we opened the second factory in Aguascalientes. So I think the combination of this, and we keep working on Sentra. On a smaller car, so on Versa Note, Versa Sedan is kind of a unique proposition on the US market with a very aggressive entry price, but very little incentive. So it's sustainable for us, and we do very well. And Versa Note gives you a combination of affordable price plus a lot of space, a lot of utility. And in fact, the Versa combined is the leader in the entry segment. Mm-hmm. So that works.
And then there's Rogue and Altima.
And Rogue, I mean this segment is booming.
Yes.
As you know, Rogue is very strong. Rogue, our only issue, I would say, is capacity, industrial capacity. We have we produce it in Smyrna. We have now complementary production from Korea, and this will increase.
Pierre Lelouan, it's been great having you here on Autoline After Hours. Real interesting to see what Nissan's doing, especially with that new Maxima. I can't wait to get a chance to drive all that. But with that, we're going to have to close up this segment. I want to thank you for your time today.
Thank you very much, both.
Thank you,
John.
Stay with us. Coming up next, we're going to have Michelle still here, Jamie Kitman, Joe Filippi. We're going to be talking about all the new things that we thought that was the best stuff at the New York show. And we'll be back right after this. You already know that you can listen to Autoline's Industry Insight in places like YouTube and Stitcher. But did you know that you can also listen to it live in your car? It's simple. Just pair your smartphone with your vehicle's Bluetooth connection or plug into the aux jack. Then navigate to Autoline.tv using your phone's browser. Find the show you want to hear and click play just like you would on your computer.
This is Autoline After Hours with John McElroy.
It's that easy. Never be disconnected from Autoline's top-notch insider information with Autoline on the go. Back at the New York Auto Show, joined now by Jamie Kitman from Automobile Magazine, Joe Filippi from Auto Trends Consulting. Good having the both of you here.
Thank you, John.
So, Jamie, let's just throw this out. What do you like at the show here? Pick one, and then we'll get to the rest of it all.
I'm intrigued by the CT6 Cadillac. I think it's...
Why?
Well, I think it's an important technological statement, and I think it's definitely going against the headwinds, it seems like, that Cadillac faces and people who build cars face in a world where, if you're in the luxury end, all the money seems to be spilling into SUVs and things like that. So to actually try to engineer a brand new rear-wheel drive car with a lot of interesting technology, it's exciting. I don't know how it'll do. You know, it could be a real disappointment, but I think... You know, it makes me kind of, you know, not to sound ridiculous, but as an American, it makes me sort of proud in a patriotic way that Cadillac is taking the fight to them. You know, I don't know if they win.
Yeah. Joe, your reactions to
John,
the CT6.
I'd echo Jamie's comments. If you look at the cutaway version that's available on the floor, you see a tremendous amount of really interesting technology, very large, high-pressure aluminum castings, all aluminum skin. That's like a first for a major American car company. A lot of interesting technologies went into it. I think there's several miles, if not far greater than that, of industrial anaerobic type adhesives that kind of glue this car together. Exotic rivets. So they're throwing in a huge amount of technology to take weight out of the car.
Yeah, and I want to come back to that in a minute, but I want to get Michelle's reaction to the car.
To me, it was a kind of a predictable evolution of their design language. There were some differences, a little bit rounded, front, but still a lot of edgy lines, and then the more rounded back. So I wasn't, blown away, shocked at what it looked like, because I sort of knew what to expect. And loading a car with technology and comfort and all the features has not been Cadillac's problem. It's all about building the brand, and it's going to have to keep just producing products over and over that are great.
Right. I mean, it was telling that if you were to evaluate, the amount of buzz things were getting in advance of the show, the Lincoln Continental was, the definite buzz victor. And I think it was partly because of the name, but mostly maybe because of the name, because on a technology level, way less interesting car, and on a style level, not, great, all right, some interesting spots, much of which, the interior is probably the best part of that car, I thought, but much of that may not really see its way into production. So So kind of hard to say.
I think the Lincoln's a really interesting car, and I think there's a lot we don't know about it because we're seeing a concept version and the production version's a ways away. To me, what it said is Lincoln's serious about being luxury, because there's been so many rumors around, are they really committed to the luxury market? Are they really committed to the Lincoln brand? To me, it said they are.
Yeah, and I think one of the ways of measuring that commitment is the fact that Mark Fields, the CEO of the company, was doing so much of the presentation. They brought in a lot of the heavy artillery executive-wise, and I think it was to convey that very message that you're raising. How serious are they with this brand?
I mean, they are investing about $2.5 plus billion, the last time I checked, you know, in this whole portfolio. And we've got additional vehicles coming out over the next 3 or 4 years to flesh out that portfolio.
That's the first I've heard this. They said they've got two more vehicles that they're going to add to the lineup, vehicles that they don't have now at all. So they're not replacing something.
Is that, are they meant to come out of that $2.5 billion investment?
I hope not. That's not enough. That's what you're getting at, right?
Yeah. Exactly.
It'll be that and more.
No, you know, because Cadillac's making a bigger investment. They're talking about eight vehicles.
And I think if you compare those cars in terms of their technology, you know, the Continental is derived really from the Fusion platform. It was a front drive, you know, chassis that they're working with, an existing one. And there's some stuff about it that certainly is cool technologically and design-wise. But and I agree that the Cadillac maybe is not the home run that it needs to be from style-wise. But in terms of, like, serious technology and going up against the Germans and the Japanese, the Cadillac is, you know, is really heads above the Lincoln, I think.
But we're seeing a concept version that we haven't really even... They are not really talking about a lot of the technology.
Well, that's because... And there's a reason for that.
Well, they're going to...
I poked and prodded as many people as I could, you know, wheelbase, powertrain, front drive, rear drive, all-wheel drive.
They're going to do a dance of the seven veils. We're going to see this as in typical Ford stat.
This car comes out in the fall of 16. So this car's locked in. They're not telling us what
they're not telling us, exactly. Because that's not the Ford way. We have to roll it out, you know, a little bit.
Think about the new Ford GT, though. I mean, that is, everybody knows everything there is to know about that. That's a really exciting car. But they're talking a lot about the technology. So I don't think it's part of some brilliant marketing strategy. I think that it still is a half-hearted effort. You know, it's better than they've been doing, but still wanting, in my view.
I want to go back to the CT6 a minute, because I like the styling. I think, you know, it's hard to judge a car in an auto show.
It
when
is.
It's up on a pedestal and the lighting's weird and all that.
Special paint.
I think if you see that thing come around the corner here in New York and just sort of emerge and pull up to a high-end hotel, it's going to look right at home. I think it's got road presence. But I only think that. I got to see it on the road to be sure about
that. You lose a little something with the white car, right?
You do.
Show me one of the really great-looking metallic colors. And the other thing is that they're sort of softening that art and science hard edge. And I think the next car, the bigger car, the big car, the S-Class competitor, is probably going to show those corners and edges around it off even to an even greater degree.
But I want to go back to what you raised, Joe, because, you know, when I saw the CT6, I think it's a good car. I think it's got good road presence. But until I saw the cutaway of the car that really shows a lot of the engineering under the skin, I didn't appreciate what they had done. And they're doing stuff I have seen no other car company yet on the planet do. So and it's more than an engineering story. It's a manufacturing story.
Right.
They're doing manufacturing techniques that no one's gotten to yet.
Right.
And so, you know, wow, is this the real revival of General Motors, that it's not just throwing some nice sheet metal over something that they're trying to drag out the tooling costs on amortizing it? They're doing significant engineering, manufacturing engineering, I haven't seen anybody do before.
Well, and if we can believe what they're saying, a lot of this stuff is only going to be resident in Cadillac. It's going to be very, very exclusive to Cadillac. So it's not going to spread to, let's say, to Buick or the bigger Chevys or something like that. Some of those lessons will.
Well, you know, some of the joining techniques,
this
laser welding that they're doing with aluminum that I guess they've got something special on, I think that will migrate to other lines.
Yeah. Also, a new rear drive chassis is a big deal, and that's something that, you know, I would have liked to think that something that Ford would have wanted to do for a new Continental. But it all kind of speaks to a rebirth of the large American car, which, you know, I used to be you know, strongly opposed to large American cars when they got 11 miles per gallon and handled horribly. Now, you know, with the weight savings and the engine management and the smaller displacement engines, you know, I think they're really viable alternatives. And it's kind of delightful in a world where, you know, everything is just a new crossover to see somebody, you know, throw some, you know, put an oar in that area, you know.
And the base engine is a four-cylinder turbo.
Yeah.
In this great big Cadillac.
And we know, to your point, Jamie, is there's a plug-in version of this Cadillac CT6 coming, and I think they're talking about a blended 70 miles per gallon with that. So even more impressive that here you got a big American sedan that's pretty efficient.
I think people could be persuaded to buy them. I think that, you know, if we learned anything in the last 30 years of since CAFE started, is people, you know, there are a lot of people just, they want a big car. And if it had to be a truck, it was going to be a truck. But if there's really a big car option, that could be a great thing for the American maker.
And let's remember, it's not just about America. Both of those cars scream China to me.
Totally.
I mean, these are, I think they'll probably do better in China than maybe in the
US. A Cadillac person told me that they hope to sell 45% of CT6s in China.
Well, they're going to assemble them there, so.
Wow.
And
this car, this new car will be assembled in China from, the get-go.
Right.
Which is...
Well, you have to, right? Otherwise, you get slapped with this 25% import tariff.
But that's a big step. That's multi-hundred million dollars of investment, you know, in another new body
shop. Lincoln's going to have to do if it's... I mean, it's saying that that's a car for China. We need to hear about the manufacturing of it there, too.
Otherwise, okay, I know we could talk more about Lincoln and Cadillac and the CT6.
They're the only ones on the show.
Yeah. What else? What else did you guys like, Joe?
Well, the new Malibu.
It's,
you know?
Yes.
Lighter, longer, more room inside. Very, you know, good, lots of knee room and foot room.
Nicely styled.
Speaking of the styling, did you guys meet the chief stylist or the guy that took the sketch from?
I know you had a meeting with him.
25 years old. So, and interesting story, they said they had all the design staff come on, put sketches on the wall, and this kid walks in, sees everything that's going on, sits down, scribbles something out, puts it up, and they go, that's it! So, look, this is great news because I love seeing young, new talent come into this industry. And I'll tell you, GM Design, they think this kid could be a rock star. We'll see what happens. Sometimes that can be the kiss of death.
Mm-hmm.
But it's cool that they went with a sketch from a 25-year-old.
And also, the interior is just way ramped
up.
I mean, that car looks like a much more expensive car than we expect it will be.
Yeah. It looks like an Audi from some angles.
Yeah. Like the A6, right?
Yeah,
with that
and the rear. Yeah,
or A7, excuse me.
There's a touch of that. I see a little A4, too, in it. But the whole show, one takeaway for me is that many years previous, I've gone like everybody's copying BMW, and now it's clear that everybody's copying Audi. You know,
And they pushed the interim panel level down and forward, so you get much better visual looking over the hood.
You know what really caught my eye? They have the name Malibu on the front doors.
In individual letters.
In individual letters. I've never ever seen that done, not in the modern era. And so it's interesting to me. Some people said that I asked about it. They said they didn't like that approach. But somehow it's got a California look to me somehow. With the name Malibu, it should.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, good point.
Okay, what else?
Well, the Civic, and it's a little bit disguised as a concept car, but Honda, that was the heart and soul of Honda and engineering expertise, so I would love to see them get their mojo back on that regard.
It's not encouraging when I heard them saying, and this time it's going to be bigger, because it's been bigger every time, and at a certain point, it's not a Civic anymore, it's an Accord, and I don't even know what an Accord becomes then.
But remember, they have the Fit that comes up underneath. Everybody's moved up because of the smaller cars coming in underneath.
Right, and the little coupe that's, if it handles like the old ones did and do, that could make it a real hit.
Well, I think it's kind of significant, though, that, they've chosen the New York show to exhibit this car. And, the last generation fell flat on its face in the eyes of the automotive media. Sales didn't do half bad, but even though they sold them, I'm not sure that it really helped the Honda brand. So my question will be, does this new one not only get us really raving about it, but does it really solidify the Honda brand for that
segment?
Bring
back the magic.
Yeah.
Well, they said that they were going to be selling the Type R, or they all but said that they'll sell the Type R here for the first time. So that's it's pretty exciting, I would think, if you're a Honda guy.
Michelle, what else do you like here at the show?
That covers the highlights for me. And, you know, I'm anxious to see the Maxima. Again, we've seen, you know, Mercedes has another SUV. And
well, what do you think of that? You know, they've had the M-Class, or then it became ML, and now it's the GLE.
I'm confused, but maybe Mercedes buyers aren't. I don't know. People ask me that. Do you know, is all that? And we see this, the same thing with Infiniti changing all the names, and now Cadillac's changing all the names.
Well, I had lunch recently with a very game Mercedes PR guy, and he spent, you know, we chatted amiably about everything but cars for a long time, and then he's like, I have to walk you through the new naming strategy. And we were there for another 40 minutes. We had like four cups of coffee before he could even explain it, and then I was confused anyway, but I think he understood it, so it can be done.
I think the one significant thing about this GLE, right, is it's the first plug-in from Mercedes, and now they're going to have a whole string of them. But, Jamie, I'll start with you first. Are plug-ins going to sell? So far, it hasn't worked.
I think the less of a price penalty there is, the more they'll sell. I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see when a company really puts marketing muscle behind selling those things. You know, they'll release them, they'll announce them, then maybe they'll talk about them, but they really haven't tried very hard so far, I don't think, to sell plug-ins and hybrids generally. There's not, you know, there's the Prius, which is sort of sui generis, but beyond that, we'll see. I mean, I think in the case of a larger vehicle that probably gets, you know, ordinary mileage, if you can have some wild number, well, like in the case of the Malibu, 46 miles per gallon city, that sounds pretty great. And a lot of people, and certainly in that market, are very running cost sensitive. In the bigger cars, probably not so much, but I think it's a way for people who might have some lingering guilt about driving something so hulking to assuage that guilt.
But having hybrids across, you know, the vast portion of your range takes away a lot of the sort of the guilt feelings that luxury car buyers or certain categories of luxury car buyers might have about spending a lot of money on a big car that doesn't get
fuel
economy. Pardon?
Do you think they have that? When I look at the sales came out today, and, you know, big utilities that, now granted, they don't guzzle the gas that they used to, but I don't seem to think that there's much guilt or concern about fuel economy, especially at the price of gas right now.
I think there's a portion of the market that's been this way. And actually, I was talking to Joe. I'm sort of hatching this theory lately about what happened to what happened to Volkswagen and Volvo, and what happened to Subaru, being somewhat slightly related. There was a class of reasonably affluent to very affluent person who always wanted a car that just said, here's a car, it's simple, there's no pretense, and I get good gas mileage. And that was kind of, you know, a defining value of Volvo owners and Volkswagen owners in the 60s and the 70s. And they kind of got away from that a bit. And I think that Subaru has profited from that. It's paradoxical because their cars just get bigger and bigger and bigger, but they get better and better gas mileage. So it's almost like they've held on to that same ethos. And I think Volkswagen and Volvo would both do well to go back and get those people. And you see efforts to do that. You know, the e-Golf that's here at the show, and the various diesels that they have. Volvo with their e-drive engines, which are really fuel efficient, finally. But they're also going to build a very big SUV, and it'll be very interesting to see what they do, since they announced the other day that they're going to be building a plant in the U.S. And it's almost impossible to imagine that they do anything else but go to some right-to-work state in the South and build a large SUV. You know, and yet, you know, I'm shedding a tiny tear inside, because I know that they will have that will really break faith with what was their core audience and their core values. And so I wish they would do something different, you know, and a little more creative. But I'm sure when you look at the numbers and the state of Alabama or Mississippi,
Georgia.
Is going like, here's $1 billion in abatements and free land, that's hard to avoid. I don't know that a northern state wouldn't do that, but then, of course, then unions become an issue. But again, for that original core of people, you know, they're not anti-union the same way that other people are. And ironically, I remember reading when I was a kid in 1972 in the presidential election that 80% of Volvo buyers supported McGovern and 100% of Saab drivers in 1972. Whereas now, I recently saw some research that almost every brand is about evenly divided between Republicans and Democrats.
Interesting.
And except for Mini, which tilts slightly more liberal. But, you know, then again, their cars are getting bigger and some of them less fuel efficient. And ironically, they weren't even at
the
show.
They aren't even here, yeah.
So at the end of the day, we have to go after the independents and figure out what they want to buy.
Yeah, I guess.
20% of the libertarians. The 20% of the electorate that are truly independent.
You know, in the way that the whole society of, you know, when you're marketing to people, you're, you know, listening to radio stations, it's getting more and more fractionalized. You know, you go after that, just that group of people who want that thing. And I do feel that those people are being underserved, the kind of the green people who are unpretentious, you know, and don't, you know, they don't need a Prius maybe, but they want a real car.
You know, what you're saying about Volvo and unions is very interesting because, of course, Volvo pioneered so many workshop labor practices that were, you know, let's integrate the workers with the process. Let's not make them just automatons who stand at the station and do repetitive work. And I'll bet you're right. I'll bet they go down south. But I'm
it's
not
a great part of their story, and it's a shame. They used to, you know, that was part of the story. And Saturn, when Saturn launched, that was a huge part of their story. It wasn't, you know, it may have been overstated, but it was really General Motors' greatest marketing triumph of the last quarter of the 20th century was Saturn, which was an ordinary car that, you know, and sub-ordinary by the end of many of its lives. And yet they told such a good story about it that it brought people who would have been buying Volvos and Volkswagens out to buy it, and they didn't even realize it was a General Motors product.
That's right. Well, I think that Volvo will probably end up down south, but more likely, not to avoid unions, but it's probably going to want to use the same supply base that BMW and Mercedes have already established, and you want to be close to your suppliers. So
somewhere along I-75.
Yeah.
Right, so all the product componentry can flow right down.
You know, and to your point about the market being so many segments, but at the same time, you know, Volvo used to own safety. Well, everybody has to own safety now, and everybody has to have fuel economy. I think it's really getting hard to distinguish your brand.
It is, although I'll give Volvo credit. You know, they were the first or one of the first, certainly in their price class, with forward collision warning, with full stop, pedestrian protection. So as long as you're the first out there, you know, first is with the most is kind of an approach, the public perception is still that they're the leader. So even though everyone else is doing the same thing, as long as you're the first one out there and advertise it, you can maintain that image.
I think the research shows that people still think Volvos are safe. Yeah. If you tell somebody in 2015, I bought a Volvo, they're like, that's safe. You know, that's a safe choice. And it may be exactly the same as something else, but... You know, so I think they own that and they can build on it. But yeah, theirs is a tough, you know, row to hoe.
So I missed the fact that you guys brought up that Mini's not at this show.
Right.
What's that about?
Well, they were offered a really crappy spot to in the North Pavilion, and they were just like, oh, the hell with it. It was, you know, it costs like $1 million to be here. They have no new model that they're introducing. It's been sort of a bad year for them, if you were going to say. The new Mini sold less in its first year than the outgoing model, which was, I mean, significantly less, which is, that's not a good sign. You know, so I think they decided to husband their resources and save it for later. But they were supposed to be next to Mitsubishi up
and
in the
Fiat.
North, and Fiat.
And Scion.
Yeah, and if they, Fiat and Scion were not happy, and their parent companies, Toyota and Chrysler, or FCA, you know, they try to leverage it into moving, but it didn't go.
And they just announced that they're going to build the Superleggera, which would have been a great opportunity here, theoretically.
Right, yeah. It was
put
part of the theme
BMW
of the
stand. Yeah. You know, yeah. Here it is. This is the concept. Remember this one? Well, now we're going to build it. Even if you do just a,
yeah,
a quick 10-minute press conference.
It's too bad, because that's a cool car.
But, you know, you talk about the North Hall, and isn't that a problem at every single auto show? Everybody wants their press conference the first day, and everybody wants the best floor space, and it's just not possible to do.
Not
ask,
here.
Ask the organizers how hard that is to carve up the space on the floor. I've seen the fights about that.
Yeah, oh, yeah. I'm sure you go to that meeting with a switchblade.
Oh, yeah.
Look at the square footage that the really high-end supercar guys have here. You know, the Lambo stand, the big stand for Maserati.
And Aston Martin
has a lot of space.
Aston Martin, absolutely. So they kind of carved out the entire middle of the
It reminded me of Geneva a little bit, you know, how the really exotics right there in the middle.
Maybe this negotiations is the same as trying to get the Olympics to your city or the World Cup, you know? It's a lot of under-the-table bakish or something.
Oh, I'll give you this much space if you give me this debut and all.
Well, it's interesting because GM regretted from day one having ended up in the North Hall, and they were, like, so relieved to get back, you know, on the main floor.
Yeah. They could tell us, but then they'd have to kill us.
They really would.
So, let's see. We've had Mercedes we talked about.
BMW didn't do a lot, did they?
Oh, there's the new XF Jaguar.
Yeah, right.
Which looked pretty good to me. You know, it's all aluminum now, finally, bringing it in line with the rest of their lineup. And it's their best-selling sedan here already, so that should do nicely for them.
What I thought was weird, though, is to me, at first glance, it doesn't look all that different. It's a total new architecture. It's a bigger car, actually, a little bit longer. A lot of changes under the skin.
Right.
And yet, you know, at first blink, it looks like the old one.
Yeah, I don't think, you know, I mean, sadly, because I actually think they're really nice cars. And if I was in the market for that class of car, I would seriously, I recommend them to people a lot to buy. And they drive them and they go, wow, this is great. You know, because they really ride better than anything. But then they go, well, you know, the reliability is not so good. And then you say, well, you know, their J.D. Power numbers are off the charts. They're doing great. And they go, yeah, but, you know, I had a friend who had one and it was a nightmare. So it's a big job for them. And, you know, I really would like to see them turn it around. And they certainly, you can't fault them for their product overall. But it's just a really hard.
It's really hard to shake those old.
Man, that's a 40, 50-year-old thing.
Yes. Yeah.
You know what we didn't talk about is the Lexus RX.
Oh yeah.
Which is a hugely important vehicle, and I mean that was the granddaddy of the crossovers, and
they were the first ones.
Yes.
I mean Lexus identified mm-hmm. that segment and jumped
and
on it before anybody did,
they still
own it.
And they own it. I mean, 25% of the market with almost doubling of the competitors.
Yeah.
In that segment.
There's like 17 competitors or something
16
like that.
Or 17. 16,
17. Yeah, it's crazy.
It's mm-hmm. Still 25%. Over 100,000 a year.
You know what I like about it is it looks pretty good, unlike the NX, which to me is, because it's shorter, it looks all hunched and I don't know. But when you stretch that form language out, it works a whole lot better.
Yeah. One car I think that, going back to Volkswagen, that I think that, is it called the Cross Track?
All Track. I think that's right.
Right. Yeah. I'm embarrassed to say. I mean, I was at the event, and I can't even remember the name.
That's not a good sign.
It was because
I can't either, Jamie.
It was because the dance music was too loud, and it addled my thinking. But that, I think, strangely, could be a very successful car for them, because it really goes right at Subaru and the legacy, I think.
And it's a German alternative.
It's a good-looking car, and it's jacked up.
Is that the one that's got those highlighted character lines that go around the wheel wells, or is that a different one?
It does.
I don't like that look myself.
You know, it's silly, really, but all crossover SUVs are silly. You know, they, you know, RX Lexus. I mean, it's a Camry that's got, you know, bigger, taller springs. You know, I mean, it's really not about going off road, but it's that style. You know, people want it.
The public wants it, and guess what? It's not just here in the U.S.
It's
CUVs
global.
Are taking over the industry globally.
I know. Yeah, we'll be gone, I think, before that trend, you know, disappears.
I had that discussion.
Nothing would make me happier, but
I had that discussion with Cadillac because they're lagging in that. They've got three coming out, an SRX replacement later, and then a smaller and a bigger one, and they're way behind. And I asked that, you know, is the trend going to run out before you get these out? And it doesn't look that way.
Hey, look, we got to take a...
Chinese market is just getting
going.
Well,
there you go.
Oh, yeah.
So watch out for the CUV craze over there.
Yeah.
We're going to take a quick commercial break. We got a whole lot more to talk about, but we're going to be back right after this.
A little chemistry goes a long way, especially when it comes to vehicle development. From enabling the use of alternate materials to withstanding extreme vehicle environments, Henkel's adhesive, sealants, and surface technologies provide solutions for every vehicle segment. Come see for yourself. Our Detroit area headquarters offers 12 research and development and testing laboratories with the ability to do full-range testing and validation on actual vehicle parts. Sign up to tour our labs at henkelna.com/tour.
Welcome back to Autoline After Hours, all coming to you from the New York Auto Show with Michelle Krebs, Jamie Kipman, and Joe Filippi. And hey, did you guys see this news? Ralph Gilles, the head of design at Chrysler, or I should say FCA USA LLC.
Headquartered in the Netherlands.
Yeah, headquartered in the Netherlands. Yeah, traded on the London Stock Exchange, I think it is. But hey, Ralph is now going to take over head of design for the entire group. Well, what do you make of this, Michelle?
I think, you know, he's been on the fast track for a long time, and I think that's probably a good move.
Nothing succeeds like success, you know, and he's been around for what's really been, I mean, we forget, you know, you really have to pinch yourself when you think about how successful FCA has been. And I remember, you know, many, many people who should have known better in 2007 and 8 going like, let it die, you know, there's nothing there, sell Jeep to the Chinese and let's just be done with it. And boy, you know, I mean, they do sell a lot of Jeeps and many of them to the Chinese, but it was a great move for Fiat and it saved Chrysler. So, and their sales just go up and up and up. You know.
What I like about the move for Ralph is, you know, go back a few years ago, he was also running Dodge and Chrysler Design. You know, Sergio loves to give everybody two jobs. And then that didn't quite work, so they put him in charge of SRT, and then I guess they decided we're not going to have SRT as a standalone brand. And so, to me, it's so great to see Ralph, who is a real design talent, take over design for the entire group.
He brings a passion that's, like, palpable.
Mm-hmm.
You see, when they introduced the new Viper, you could just see almost tears in his eyes as they popped the cover on the new Viper. So he brings a passion that... I think it's just going to be great for the brand, which is obviously going to be great for the company.
And certainly the Chrysler 300, which he's credited with styling, is you know, it's kind of a modern design icon. It was, you know, a lot of cars are still aping it. You know, you see elements of it even in the Continental,
mm-hmm.
I thought.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah, very much so.
So Chrysler sales were up for the last month. And, Joe, I think they say this is like 60 consecutive months.
Yeah, the 60th straight month.
Yeah, are they pulling fast ones here? Or they are, is this a legitimate increase?
They've got some pretty aggressive incentives in the marketplace. But Jeep was a real powerhouse in the market, and they only sold about 1,000 Renegades. So Renegades,
that's only just getting going.
Yeah, it's just starting. Yeah.
And their sales were up 25% with only 1,000 Renegades.
How it was going up even when they didn't have Cherokees.
Oh, yeah.
And
it's amazing. And you also, you know, they were starting from a pretty low place. So probably the first 36 months were just like, you know, coming back from complete flatline. But it's true. It is incredible.
But the new Grand Cherokee has just been a flat-out runaway hit.
It's a home run.
And so was the Cherokee, and people didn't think it would be, but I knew
Wrangler.
It was.
Headlights.
Day
everybody
one,
hated the headlights.
I knew
and everybody.
I got to tell you, when I came to New York here earlier this week, I decided I'm just going to walk down Fifth Avenue, because this is the big city, and I don't get to experience it that much. I saw more Jeep Rubicons parked on Fifth Avenue than I've seen anywhere else in the world. What's that about?
Well, Jeep is aspirational for everybody. It's global, and I don't even think they've tapped that by any stretch.
No, they're not done yet.
There's a lot of potential there, but and we see it in our studies. It's very aspirational for young buyers. It's aspirational for older buyers. It just cuts across.
But this
so
is
many.
The Rubicon. These had full roll cages.
Yeah.
They had winches. They had fire extinguishers. I mean, it was the full boat Rubicon. For the Rubicon Trail, and of course, the streets here.
Yeah.
They're pretty rough.
I think a lot of people persuade themselves that they need it because the streets are so rough. And, it's certainly, as a image projection device,
there's
very little like it. Although I was amused at the show to see the first Range Rover that's really breaking the $200,000 barrier, the SV Autobiography. Which is...
what's that about? I missed that.
The most luxurious Range Rover ever made.
Yeah, Range Rover, who were also going gangbusters, they're the engine of Jaguar Land Rover's profitability, they were selling more and more of them, but, they were sort of mired in like $110,000, $120,000, $30,000. And suddenly, there's a Bentley SUV coming, a Lamborghini, a Rolls Royce, and, you can see that there's a big enough market for luxury SUVs that they could get more money, and so they filled it with as much content as possible, and it's quite luxurious. I mean, it's insane inside. But my feeling is that they probably are thinking that they shot low again. That where's the $300,000?
No kidding.
They're going to come up with something because it's like, what are we doing here? Why they're going to come? The Rolls Royce SUV is going to crest $400,000. What are we doing selling a $200,000 car when the Queen drives her car and we could get more money for them?
Look at Mercedes pricing on the G60. What is it? 65, I think. It's like $225,000, and there's no top.
It's incredible.
A brand that we should talk about because it introduced two new cars at the show at the exact opposite end of the spectrum is Scion. They have this IM and this IA. I think the IA starts in 16 and change.
Right.
Joe, is this going to do it for them, though? Because when you come out, when you look back to when Scion launched, it looked pretty good, pretty damn good. They had pretty solid sales, and now it's like nowhere.
They were great, fun vehicles. And you'd see people driving around in an XB. A guy that's like 55, 60 years old, maybe got a ponytail, happy as a clam driving along in this. But that was the wrong guy that they were aiming at. So we'll see whether...
Although my son drives one, so...
Oh, wow. Right.
Well, what do you think, Michelle? Is this going to finally get Scion back on track? New product always helps.
It helps, and the one looks pretty good. The one has the IA kind of has a funny grill front.
I like that one, actually. Yeah, they say it's very polarizing.
Oh, I would say that's probably true.
But that's
true.
The one I like, because I thought the IM, which I guess we're going to have to pronounce I'm, I am in favor of that one. But it looked very Yaris to me.
Yeah.
Sonic-y to me. But
I think they were a classic case of, they didn't understand the youth market. They ended up developing something that had a very loyal following. That had some young buyers, but as Joe was saying, that it attracted an old audience. And then they really broke faith with their audience, who were buying. Again, many of them could afford something else, but they wanted a simple, cheap car that was without pretense and was kind of funky looking. And then, so what did they do? They sold like 190,000 cars their first couple of years.
Yeah, big number.
They were up there. And then they introduced a car that was bigger, like 700 to 900 pounds heavier, got, palpably worse gas mileage. And so they basically, all the core values they threw out the window, and they said, our research showed us that people wanted a bigger car that got worse gas mileage or something. In fact, it wasn't the people who were buying them before, and they didn't because their sales went down. So to the extent that, I think the marketing was very muddled, the product planning was super muddled. It's not clear to me, just looking at those cars, that they've righted, right?
It's less muddled.
Yeah, that they've righted the cart, you know. Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I'll say this about Toyota. They never give up. They never give up.
And they can afford to do it.
Well, yeah, boy, can they ever. But, you know, if you look at the evolution of their minivans until they finally really got to the Sienna that they have today, I think most of, certainly the American companies would have given up probably first generation. Just went, whoop, we can't do this. And same with their pickup, you know, they kept growing it. So it'll be interesting. Do they have that same stick-to-it-ness with a brand that only exists in the U.S. market?
I keep wondering where's the little SUV, micro compact SUV that sort of lifts it up, you know, gets after that particular type of customer.
From Scion?
From Scion.
Yeah.
Even if it's only another 2 inches of ride height,
It would seem that within the company that Scion is treated differently. Because usually, as you rightly point out, Toyota, you know, you see each generation gets a little better, and they dial in on that sweet spot, like the Camry, you know, like they just kept getting more and more like what people wanted. Scion, they went off the rails, and it doesn't seem like they really know what they're trying to do with it. You know, they're certainly capable and qualified to do anything in the world, but it just doesn't seem like they have a clear picture of what they're doing in mind.
Yeah.
I think you got to put Akio on the case and see if he can, you know, infuse.
He said that was a priority.
Major enthusiasm into the portfolio.
Speaking of small cars, have you guys seen the new Smart 4-2?
I have not.
I did last night at the Mercedes party. It's definitely an improvement, but it would be
hard not to.
Exactly.
That is not saying much.
I'm so low, everything looks up.
it's interesting, and I can't wait to drive it, really, because it being somebody who drives a lot in New York, I love really small cars. It's so fun to drive up and park in front of the place where all your friends who happen to bring cars are like desperately looking for parking spaces or spending $60 to park their car. So really the Minis got too big. They used to be that, but they're not anymore. The Fiat 500 is my current champion, except for the Smart Car. Other than that, with the first generations, there was absolutely nothing to recommend them, except that they said, "Well, I'm marching to the beat of my own drummer, and I'm unpretentious, but."
Well,
show off about it.
Talk about car companies that don't give up. I'm stunned that Daimler has stuck with the Smart brand. What's it now, 20 years that it's been out? And it's never made a dime for them. Never a dime, but they won't give up. And now this new one's based on the Renault Twingo platform, right? Yeah. So they'll get some cost sharings there that they didn't have on the prior design. And if this thing drives well, maybe it will finally pay off for them.
It could, and I think, probably even if they just get back to their first year of selling 25,000 a year, it'll have done its job for them, which I think is, it's an image thing as well. I mean, in fairness, they did spend a lot of money to acquire Smart, and they lost money every year. It wasn't like they were pouring money into developing it very much. So, you know, they were saving money big time that way. What I'm interested to see, and I still think there's a market out there for, especially as global warming continues to be an issue and people want to address that in their car purchases, is where is the hyper luxury super mini, you know? And Aston Martin had a try at that, which I think was a great idea. It was flawed in the execution because it looked an awful like an IQ Toyota, which is what it was based on. But I think that there really is that kind of rich person city car. You know, people will buy it, you know, under the right set of
done
circumstances.
Right.
Done right.
Done right.
And, which is a huge investment because you don't, you know, you can't just make it the way you can make a Ferrari show car. It's really a lot of intensive engineering to make something so small and make it really good and luxurious. So that's no doubt is what's keeping it from us. But I want that day to come, too.
Yeah. Okay, final thoughts. We got to wrap this up. Michelle, final thoughts of the New York Auto Show.
Well, it was an impressive show. I thought it had a lot of substance. Luxury was the big theme. I hadn't been here in a year or two, a couple shows, and so I was really impressed. Big crowds of media people, so impressive show.
Yeah, Jamie, your thoughts?
Industry seems prosperous, and they're trying some interesting things. There's, it's clear that they love to chase the big money, and that's, probably the biggest takeaway for me is that they're sure a lot of big money to chase.
Joe, your observations?
Well, the industry's doing very well. We're on the way on our way back. Profitability is really good for almost across the board. We still have the profit drivers of SUVs and big pickup trucks, but it's clear the number of introductions at the show and a lot of excitement at the show. We didn't see a lot of that in the prior couple of years. So this has been a big year.
The other thing that I walk away from the show is starting to get a better sense of the cadence, not of product planning, but of auto shows. Because I know a number of automakers were thinking, geez, the next big show in the United States is late November in L.A. And so we've got this huge gap. And they actually pulled product forward that they probably really would have rather waited a little bit. But this is how the auto show cadence goes.
Right.
So it's not just a product cadence. It's how do you bring this out to the public?
It's a marketing cadence.
It is.
Keep the excitement
at
a boil.
I love being here. I think the Big Apple is a fun place to be.
It is.
Thanks for
coming. Great having the three of you guys.
Thanks.
Yeah, really appreciate it. Want to thank all of you for having tuned in and join us again next week for AutoLine After Hours.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Henkel, excellence is our passion.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live. Get your daily news fix with Autoline Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with Autoline This Week. There is all that and much more at autoline.tv.